This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
My name is Alex Israel, and I do several things here at Pardes when I'm not teaching in the classroom. I run the community education program, which is a program whereby people come in, mostly retiree population, but of anybody who wants to join a class in Pardes who is visiting Israel or who lives here can come in for morning classes, and we have several mornings where we have classes. We also have a tour program, and I'm also responsible for the evening lectures here. And then, you know, that's not enough, so I'm also responsible for the summer program. So it's really amazing because on a weekly basis, we have over 150 people coming in for classes in the mornings. Sometimes we'll have evening lectures which can range anything from 30 people to 230 people. We can't really fit more than 230 people in our Bet Midrash. And then the summer program, which we're really delighted over the last few years, has grown from 50 people to now we have two summer programs with over 150 people in our summer programs. One three-week program during July and the second sort of going into August. So those are the things I do here at Pardes, and you're, you know, welcome to join us for any of those things. That means that, you know, if you happen to be not on the Executive Learning Seminar but just in Israel for some business meetings or what have you, on a Monday, Tuesday, or Thursday morning, there are classes here. Just come in for a class. You don't even need to tell us you're coming. Just come in and you join the class, and that's the way it goes. And likewise, tell people, maybe you know, by the way, the summer program is really amazing because it's very multi-generational in the sense that probably two-thirds of the program are 18 to 30, but a good third of the program is above that age, and I'd say 45 plus. In fact, on our feedback forms, we frequently get feedback from the younger population saying how much they enjoyed the mix of ages, and that's sort of refreshing for them. So it's really something you can tell people in your communities about, you can tell your children about, you can tell whichever age. We always used to say that our program was for age 19 to 91, and then our 91-year-old turned 92, and it ruined the publicity. But it's really amazing. I get the chance to do the programs in Pardes, which are everything which is not the year program and not the educators program. And this, in many ways, is sort of some of the long reach of Pardes. Yes. So what we do, I'm actually teaching a class on Tuesday mornings on the Book of Joshua. And so what we do is about 5-6 times a year, we go out into the field and go visit places that we're studying about. So during a period between, let's say, Sukkot and Pesach, during the winter, spring period, we're following a certain theme, usually based on biblical themes. And then in our program, which we do after Passover, sort of what we call our Omer program, we usually base it around modern Israeli themes. So, for example, one of the tours that I'm putting together is for this May is going to be called Presidents and Prime Ministers, and we're going to be walking through Rehavia and visiting the hut of Ben Tzvi. I don't know if you know about that. President Ben Tzvi was somebody who he was the president in the 50s. When there was rationing in Israel, and when people, many of the new immigrants were in Ma'abarot, were in transit camps, and even though he was the president of the state of Israel, he refused to live in a house. He lived in a hut because he refused to live on a different level to the people. And they said, "Well, you can't have people. You can't like receive visitors in your hut." So he said, "Well, we'll have another hut for them." And this hut was decorated with all sorts of art, and it's really amazing. And there are a couple of other, like, presidential or prime minister's houses in Rehavia, so we're going to do a tour based around all of those. So sometimes we'll be on biblical themes, sometimes we'll be doing things on more modern themes, and exploring different aspects. And I think it's really enriching. We have, for people who are living here, because we have, like, if I take the average week on community education, so Meir will be teaching a class on Introduction to the Siddur. Mike will be doing Jewish history. I'm teaching a Bible course. We've got Shai Finkelstein teaching contemporary halakha and how halakha, he's just been doing a whole unit on abortion and all sorts of interesting medical technology. Then we have a class on Jewish philosophy, a class on Israeli literature. So we're really covering lots of different areas, which hopefully we feel that even some people come all three mornings and they get a whole potpourri of different things. And other people come in for the particular class they want, which will sort of fill in their area, which they feel, you know, that's where they want to enrich themselves. So that's what we're doing. Yes?
Yeah. And with the community program, so the courses are set up, it seems like, as a semester, but the idea being that if you were here for 1 week and you can take all of the, you could, like, create your own little, like,
100%. So some people, we have our group of, I don't know, snowbirds who come like for 3 months to the program. We have some people living here and they come all year round. But we tell our teachers to make sure they do an introduction at the beginning of class to bring people up to speed and try and make sure that any given class, that you'll get something out of it on its own right. And we actually advertise, you know, if you're in Jerusalem, drop in for a class, and that's how we build the program. So the problem is, a lot of people want to come in and visit classes at Pardes. And, you know, we don't always want to disrupt the year program. And sometimes it's very unsettling when the constitution of the class is changing the whole time. So this way, everybody expects it. In the community education program, you know, anyway, the sort of population that we have, sometimes they're off, you know, to the States for a bar mitzvah of their grandson. Or people can't make it because they've got a medical appointment. So I never quite know exactly who will be in the class. There's no attendance taken. And it's a comfortable environment where people can come in and access Pardes and Pardes teaching and our wonderful faculty. So that's what we have. So I don't know if there are any other questions. Anyway, I'm a Tanakh teacher. So I usually teach in the area of Bible, sometimes a bit of Jewish thought. And so that's sort of what we're going to focus on today. So let's begin with our topic, which is called, oh, what a lovely topic, when brother fights brother. This is totally hypothetical, by the way. Jews never fight. No, what I was going to say is that, to start off with, a couple of years ago, we did a course on famous Jewish controversies in Jewish history. And it was a 10-week course. It started off with the conflict between Korach and Moshe was the first class, then the Maccabees and the Hellenists, then the Pharisees and the Sadducees, Sadia Gaon and the Karaites, moving on to Maimonides and his critics. Then I just took the course description. Chassidim and Innagdim, Shabtai Tzvi and fake messiahs, Reform and Orthodox, Zionism and anti-Zionists, and then women of the wall in the Israeli government, right? That was the course. And in each one, they tried to explain the basis of the argument, the major personalities, what they were arguing about, and how it was resolved, if at all. So brother never fights brother in the Jewish world. This is the reality that we live. I want to try and talk about today, together with you and study with you, a very, very fundamental conflict in the history of the Jewish people. And it is essentially the conflict between two forces in the Jewish people. If I want to try and describe it, maybe I would start off here. And I would say that during the first temple period, the kingdom of Israel split into two. There was a single kingdom, the kingdom of David, the kingdom of Solomon. And after King Solomon, the king splits into two. We have in the south Judah, and in the north you have the kingdom of Israel, sometimes called the kingdom of Ephraim. And for over 200 years, the kingdom of Israel was divided into two separate states with frequent conflict and altercations between one and the other. What we're going to do today is really trace that historic conflict. We're going to do that together in the first few minutes together. Then we're going to try and draw on the roots of this conflict. Because if I go back, and you will see this on your source sheets as well, if you look earlier on to page 5, but I'll draw it here and say
the following, that if we take the two people, Ephraim and his brother Manasseh, are the children of, anybody?
Joseph.
Okay, these are the children of Joseph. Joseph's mother, Rachel. That's the northern kingdom. Okay, by the way, interestingly enough, that kingdom goes along with all the other 10 tribes. And when sometimes we talk about the lost 10 tribes, maybe you've heard of the lost 10 tribes, we'll talk about this in a minute. That means the northern kingdom. Because the northern kingdom was exiled in 721 BCE and was dispersed to many different locations, and the identity of those tribes simply got lost. Sometimes you hear people talking about a tribe in India, a tribe in Africa, somewhere, who claim they're descendants of the lost tribes, and they might be. Okay, but as a self-identifying Jewish community, they sort of disappeared, they assimilated. Judah was exiled much later, okay, in the year 586 BCE, and we know that we are actually called Yehudim, Jews, because it was this kingdom who went into exile, came back, rebuilt themselves, and that's how Judah was the one that continued, later called Judea, and we are Jews because we are all descended from this kingdom. By the way, I will say, we certainly have the DNA of all the tribes in us, because tribes intermarried and mixed, and many people migrated south to Judah. I'll even say there's a very, very famous line in Megillat Esther, in the book of Esther, which says that Ish Yehudi haya b'shushan habira u'shmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish ishimini. There was a Yehudi who was in Shushan. His name was Mordechai, right? The son of Yair, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. It's the first time we hear somebody from Binyamin calling himself a Ish Yehudi, right? A Judean, but really means a Jew. In other words, whether you were from any of the tribes, Zebulun or Asher or Reuven, people started calling themselves Jews, Judeans, if you understand, because they were in the state of Judah, even though they were ethnically from another tribe. What am I saying? The split between Ephraim and Judah. So on the other hand, we have Judah. Let's put it, try again. Judah, and his mother is?
Leah.
Okay? So what we're seeing, what I'm going to claim, and we're going to get back to it, and this is really going to be the thesis of our class, is that there is this split between the kingdom of Ephraim and the kingdom of Judah. This goes back to, if you want, this tension in the Joseph story itself between Joseph and Judah. By the way, I will mention that one tribe sits on the borderland between Ephraim and Judah, and that is the tribe of Benjamin. Isn't that interesting? How, in the Joseph story, who's knocked about between Joseph and Judah? Who are they arguing about, right?
Benjamin.
Right? Benjamin is, interestingly enough, in the Joseph story, right between Joseph and Judah. And in terms of the tribal entities, Judah in the south, Benjamin, and then Ephraim and Manasseh, the Joseph tribes. Right? So interesting how the geography of the land of Israel mirrors the narrative of the story of the Bible. I'm going to claim it goes even deeper, that it's going to go back to Rachel and Leah, these two sisters, both of whom end up marrying Jacob. And what I'm going to say is that this conflict is very deeply rooted in the DNA of the Jewish people. So that's where we're going to be going. But first I want to substantiate this and try and explain how this all works.
Alex, can you just touch for one second on why it is sort of traditionally, historically, that it is known as Ephraim and Judah, which is obviously, you know, two different generations,
mm-hmm.
Why? How did it come to be that it isn't commonly known as Joseph and Judah in the battle, in the altercation that you're about to talk about?
You mean why are they given the name Ephraim?
It's a mix of generations.
So in the land of Israel, there are various tribal portions. So you will have, you will see that the land of Israel is divided into tribes.
Okay.
And for example, here you'll have Judah in the south, you'll have Benjamin, Ephraim, Manasseh over here, Yisachar in Emek Yisrael, Dan is up here, Asher is up here, Zebulun, etc. How did it come to be called Ephraim in particular? Right? How did this... And what I'm saying is that the country split into two over here. There was definitely a southern state led by the Judean kings. And the Judean kings, we're talking about David, Solomon, and all the kings of the southern kingdom are from Malchut Beit David. They're from the actual line, the Davidic line. The northern kingdom is more problematic. But I will simply say this. The northern kingdom, at an earlier point, before King David, it was led by Saul, who is also a Rachel character. He's not descended from Joseph, he's descended from Benjamin. Saul is a Benjamin, he's from Benjamin. But later on, the northern kingdom was set up by Jeroboam, Yerovam. And Yerovam is from the tribe of Ephraim. And it seems like always the strongest tribes in the northern kingdom, and they actually take up most of the main hill land, is Manasseh and Ephraim. And somehow Ephraim, maybe being the more senior of the two, it got labeled with Ephraim. Either because Yerovam, the founder, was from Ephraim, that's option A, or B, because it's really the Joseph brother, the Joseph sons, who are the mainstay, the strongest unit in this group. And being the strongest unit in this group, and Ephraim being the leader in that regard, it got labeled the name Ephraim. But it's given two alternative names, either Israel or Ephraim. And this is by the prophets, if you open Jeremiah and whoever it is, and we'll see a couple of variations where we go through. So let's take a look at our page one. And I want to just trace through this conflict before we go and study. We're already going to start off with the thesis of how we might get into trouble here. And what I mean by how we might get into trouble and we might actually, the conflict might be set up, is set up here by the Book of Chronicles. You know what, even before we look at the Book of Chronicles, just take a look at the family tree on page 5. Jacob has four wives, okay? And if we take the Zilpah and Bilhah are called handmaids, so we'll take the main wives, Leah and Rachel. Okay, Leah has six male children. And the first is Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Judah, Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zebulun. We usually expect the leader to be the firstborn. Okay, that would be the default assumption. In which case, Reuven should be the leader. It seems like Reuven engaged in a sin that the Bible tells us in chapter 35 of Bereshit, that he slept with Bilhah. It's not clear what exactly happens there. It's certainly beyond the ambit of this class. And it seems like, and we're told explicitly in the Bible that for that he lost his role in the leadership. Shimon and Levi, somebody tell me about what they did. Shechem, right? They massacre a city in Shechem, and they're seen as in some way reckless or hotheads, and maybe the hands of leadership are not suitable for them. And therefore it goes to Judah. On the other side, Rachel has a firstborn called Joseph. Okay, so now let's look at the way the Book of Chronicles puts it. The sons of Reuven, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel. Okay? So that he is not entitled to the birthright. So now tell me, who's going to lead the family?
Joseph.
Joseph. 1 minute.
Sons of Joseph.
The sons of Joseph. Great. But now look at verse 2.
For Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came the leader, yet the birthright is to Joseph.
What is the birthright?
What is the birthright? Good question. Okay, I don't know what the birthright is. I'm going to make a suggestion. Nowhere is it fully explained. I will say the birthright could be something religious, that there was a sort of right to the firstborn to lead the family in terms of religiosity. We have something interesting in Roman society where you have the patros or the patron of the family who was considered almost like the patriarch of the family. And it doesn't, and they sort of led the family in all things. The blessings of the family were seen to go through the patron of the family. This was part of Roman culture. And birthright is some form of leader, whether it's true in a nuclear family or whether it's true in sort of in the chamula, in the clan, right? Like I know that when in my family, right, my grandfather lived to almost 100 years old. And, you know, when he's in his 90s, we really looked at him as being, he was the oldest person by far of anyone we knew. He had so many descendants. We all looked up to him, even all my friends called him Grandpa, right? Grandpa Joe was Grandpa Joe, and that was it. He was really, so maybe it could be like that, that somebody is earmarked as being the head of the family, whether for the nuclear family or for the clan, but some sort of leadership. Now, what I want to point out here in this verse is how strange these verses are. Because, of course, it says that Joseph is given the birthright. And what about Judah?
He's the leader.
Right. So, but the problem is, when you give somebody two people, unless you define, who is the president and who is the, CEO, and you distinguish those two roles, you can have some serious clashes. And I imagine in certain corporations you have clashes anyway, right? So how, in our country, you have distinct roles for the president and for the prime minister, right? If you hadn't defined those roles, you'd be in trouble. In Judaism, these roles are not defined. And as you clearly asked, right, what exactly is the birthright? What rights does it give you? What responsibilities does it give you? In the same thing, what does it mean? He is the leader, right? Ulanagid, remember, that's usually a word for a king. So if Judah's the king, what does that leave to Joseph? I would actually argue that this leads to a situation of conflict where two people think that they're the leader and they're clashing. And that's certainly true in terms of the family of Jacob, where there seems to be a serious contest over who's going to lead the rest of the clan, and is it going to be Joseph or is it going to be Judah? Somebody had a question.
But yes. Who gave the birthright to him in the first place?
Right. Oh, who gave it to Joseph?
Yeah.
Right? Who gave it to him? It's not said. I simply want to set up this. There seem to be two potentials for leadership in the family, and this is a recipe for conflict. Could say disaster. It's a recipe for conflict. Now, one could say if the two learn to work together as a sort of as a duo, that works fine. Well, that's great when there's goodwill. What when there isn't? Now, I want to show you something interesting. As we go through history, okay, one can talk about the history of, let's say, I'll draw a scale here, okay? So we'll go through a few periods. We've got the period of the Torah itself, then the period of the book of Joshua, which is the period of the conquest, then the periods of the judges, monarchy, which leads, in the end, to the period of the exile. I'm just using this scale to map these sources that you find here, okay? Because we're already being told that in the period of the Torah, there is a conflict between the characters of Joseph and Judah as actual people. And we've just been reading in our Torah portions the actual physical conflict between the personality Joseph and the personality Judah, even before they become tribes and become identities, group identities. Yes?
Did Judah leave Egypt or did he die there as well?
All of the 12 sons of Jacob all die in Egypt. And that's the families stay, they become more and more numerous in Egypt. When the Exodus happens, it's interesting, they take the coffin. Joseph's bones they take out of Egypt. There is a tradition that all of the brothers' bones are taken out, but nothing said explicitly. So, yes, Joseph dies in Egypt, Judah dies in Egypt, all their descendants remain there. Okay? All right. I want to just... We're going to go sort of quickly through the story. But if you look at source number two, here we have the beginning of the period of the monarchy. And we're talking about King Saul. And what does it say there? Saul mustered them in a place called Bezek, nothing to do with the phone company. And the Israelites numbered 300,000, and the men of Judah, 30,000. Again, next chapter, chapter 15, source number three. Saul mustered the troops and enrolled them in Telaim, 200,000 men on foot and 10,000 men of Judah. I've got an interesting question. Why do you always count Judah separately? Why do they consider themselves to be separate? What's going on with this counting the Judah people? Always, it's like all the 10 tribes are buddies, and Judah, you're out over there. And what's interesting here is that this becomes a fault line or a seam line which seems to constantly unravel. I know I'm running through events which you don't quite know, but I'm trying to describe a particular phenomenon. So take a look in source number four. I'll just give you the background to this particular event. The event goes like this. David is the king. David's son stages a mutiny against him. His son Absalom, Absalom, stages a mutiny against him. And actually David has to run for his life from Jerusalem. But David eventually wins. David's army general Joab kills David's son and puts down the rebellion. And David is now back being king. And all of the tribes of Israel come to the Jordan River to reinstall David and march back with him to Jerusalem. At which point we're going to see a big argument, right? What's going to happen is like this. Benjamin, as the representative of the northern tribes, are going to come and say, we want to lead the procession. And Judah are going to say, no, we want to lead the procession. He's our king. He's from our tribe. And they're going to say, so look what happens. Then the men of Israel answered the men of Judah. And they said, we have 10 shares in the king. There are 10 of our tribes, right? So we have a greater claim on David than you have. Why do you treat us with contempt? Weren't we the first to speak of bringing back our king? But the men of Judah pressed their claims even more forcibly than the men of Israel. Now an evil man named Sheba, son of Bichri, a Benjaminite, happened to be there. And he sounded the trumpet and said, we have no share in David, no part in Jesse's son, every man to his tent of Israel. And what do? They blow the shofar and they say, fine, Judah, you don't like us? We're going home. We're leaving. We're splitting, right? We're seceding. We'll make our own separate country. David is a very clever leader, and David manages to reunite the kingdom, and it remains reunited during David's time and during Solomon's time. But, and again, so wild that this can break apart, but here we get to the end of Solomon's reign. Solomon has been an incredible king. He set up the temple. He has taken the country to a period where its borders are wider than they've ever been. We have no record of war. Throughout the 40 years of Solomon's reign, the country seems wealthy. It says Israel and Judah, again, Israel and Judah were happy. Each person under their vine and under their fig tree. The living is easy in the time of Shlomo's time, right? That's what they say. And yet, it seems that as the country continues, the economy worsens. And I think there's a case of the country producing less and consuming more, which I don't know if we have any economists in the room. But you gain the sense that by the end of Solomon's time, there's a bit of a recession going on. And what we know this from the fact that the demand for Solomon's successor is... Anybody know what one demand from Solomon's son? Lower the tax rates. We can't. The tax rate is crushing. Okay? Solomon's son, who's grown up in the lap of luxury, says, no. Right? I'll be your king, and I'll put whatever taxes I want. What do the people say? Source number five, the division of the kingdom. If you need a heading for this, source five. When all Israel saw the king did not listen to them, the people answered, saying, what portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. And this is the point where the kingdom splits. Do you notice how they are quoting the same line that we saw in Source 4? A line that had been said 60 years ago, right? This was a soundbite, a election slogan, a clarion call, which they recycled from 60 years ago. And this is the point the kingdom splits to an irreparable point. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that there seems to me, I'd say it this way, the best equivalent I can think of in modern Israel is the Ashkenazi-Sephardi divide, right? Ashkenazim and Sephardim get on very well in the army. We get on very well in our workplaces. But I find that every single election, there's a politician who tries to drive a wedge between these Ashkenazim and Sephardim and, you know, in one way or another. Now, there are grievances on each side and what have you, right? But it's very interesting that when you have a sort of different ethnic identities, right, you can frequently, those ethnic, you know, it's actually amazing when it comes to Ashkenazim and Sephardim. I find it a strange phenomenon. Ask an Ashkenazi to daven in a Sephardi shul, right? It's like, oh my God, it takes so long. They say every word alive. A Sephardi to daven in Ashkenazi shul. It's so cold. What is wrong with those Ashkenazim? They have no life in them, right? It's the same prayer book, more or less, really. I mean, like, can we just get a sense of perspective? There's something very, very deep in ethnic, you know, people will go to a Sephardi wedding. Oh, I couldn't stand that music, right? And they'll go to a Sephardi wedding, Ashkenazi. How much they were all part of the same family, right? I wonder if we can think of, like, maybe other differences. I have no idea whether Americans feel this way. I don't know, between northern states and southern states. Is there that? I don't know. We want to talk about. I mean, there are other differences, whether you want to take it blue states and red states or, you know, whatever it might be, you know, city people and people from the Midwest, right? I don't know how you want to. Here I'm talking about where there seems to be some sort of an ethnic base, and it might be over a question of taxation, economics. It might be a question of honor. Who does the king really care about? It might be over a question of nothing, just rallying the troops, and those troops don't even want to fight with those troops. 200,000 of Israel and 20,000 from Judah. You know, we're not going to share the same bathroom, sorry. Right? I don't know how that happened, but it's almost like we've got these separate people who see themselves as ethnically different, and it's on this fault line. But the kingdom can easily become unraveled. Now, I want to show how deeply this goes, because this northern kingdom and this southern kingdom that I spoke about before is split from the time of Solomon for all time. They never get back together again. As I said, the northern kingdom is exiled in 721, the southern kingdom in 586, and when we come back, there is no northern kingdom. Right? And during the period of, I've been reading texts on the period of the monarchy, but during the period of the exile, there is a prophet called Ezekiel. Ezekiel has some incredible fantasy prophecies, but I just want to read what he hopes for when the Jews will return. And this is what he hopes for. He says, "The word of God came to me," source number 6 on page 1, "and said, Son of man, take a stick of wood." In the Hebrew, by the way, it actually says eitz echad. I'm not sure it's a stick of wood. It might be. What would you say is an eitz is a tree. Take a tree. You know, a tree in a pot, maybe. A sapling. "And write on it, to Judah and Israel, his friends. And then take another stick of wood and write on it, to Ephraim and the entire house of Israel, his friends." So you're going to take two sticks and put them together. And then it says, "Join them together into one stick, so they will become one in your hand. And when your countrymen ask you, what you tell us, what mean you by this?" So what they're going to do is, now by the way, this can't naturally happen, right? You can't take two sticks and mold them. If they were metals, maybe you could make an alloy, you can make a hybrid. But two pieces of wood really cannot fuse. You might be able to stick them together, but they can't really become one. By the way, that's why I suggested that it might be that they're actually trees. Because actually, with trees, you can graft trees together. And what I would like to actually suggest is that possibly, and by the way, they do this in Israel. I don't know if any of you are into sort of grapes and the wine industry. But sometimes they will take a vine which has grapes which are particularly good, but sometimes the soil, especially in the Judean hills, is very rocky, or up in the Golan is very rocky, right? Volcanic soil in the Golan. So they'll take a very hardy root of a vine and put a better varietal of grape on it. They'll create a new vine with hardy roots, but a better grape. And that would create a much more resilient. That would be an example of taking one tree and another tree, and then what will you happen? And you will become one in your hand. It actually becomes a single organism. And you become better, right? You become better because you take the advantages of A and the advantages of B. And when you say, your country will say, verse 18, won't you tell us what you mean by this? So says the Lord, I will take Israel from the nations where they've gone. I will gather them from all around. I'll bring them back to their own land. I'll make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel. There will be one king over all of them, and they will never again be two nations or be divided into two kingdoms. This is a, by the way, this is the prophecy which immediately follows the valley of the dry bones of Ezekiel, if some of you know that prophecy. This is a futuristic, I would even say fantasy on the part of Ezekiel, because it hasn't happened yet, and he's dreaming of a history where the scar which has plagued the body politic of the Jewish people for hundreds of years, that there are two warring states of Israel, the states of Judah in the south with their royal house, and the states of Ephraim or Israel in the north with their royal house, two completely separate royal houses, right? And sometimes there's been genuine conflict between the two. In one case, by the way, they married into each other and they tried to unite. But then it was sort of racked by revolution and it didn't quite work out. But to think that we see ourselves traditionally as 12 tribes, as one family, and this family has been divided with sometimes a real border between. There's one period where they actually start building a sort of like Berlin Wall, a Great Wall of China, a Great Wall of Israel, right, between the north and south, to literally divide it off and stop migration from north to south. And there's a scar there. And Ezekiel says, wait, can't we just graft ourselves together and become one people with one king? Right? Can't we do that? And that's what he prophesies. I think we're all still waiting. We still talk about all the debates about Jewish unity, right? Peoplehood, Jewish unity. You know, that comes in all sorts of iterations, whether you want to talk about Orthodox and non-Orthodox. The latest iteration that everybody's talking about is Israel and diaspora. We're still talking about our different centers and can we get along? What, isn't that what the GA, what are the GA, can we talk? What was the slogan for the GA this year?
We need to talk,
okay? We need to talk, right? Okay? In other words, so we're still talking about this elusive unity. Now I'm going to claim that at some level, I'm going to make it harder for ourselves. Because I called it a few minutes ago an ethnic divide, and maybe it is, between Joseph and Judah. But I see this almost as a congenital birth flaw, which goes back to the birth of the Jewish nation. And as I said, goes back to these two sisters, who Rachel and Leah, and there seems to be something which really goes back to the very fundamental DNA of our people. What was going on between these two sisters who are both sort of like competing for the same husband? These two sisters who are described, you know, in a really interesting way, very, very differently, who fight together. And I want to go back to their story, and that's what we're going to do, B'chavruta, okay? And go look at their story and see what we can make of it. And where we're going to be leading is to discuss that story, but also then to discuss how two very interesting modern thinkers, Rav Steinsaltz and Rav Kook, have characterized Rachel and Leah in a modern context. So what we're going to do is we're going to turn to the story of Rachel and Leah, which you see on page 2 and on page 3. And I want you to examine the biblical story. You can see it in source number, it's all here in source number 7, chapter 20. You got it there? Chapter 29 and chapter 30. Yeah, I want you to study that story. Now, where you see on page 2 at the bottom, I've sort of divided it into different segments. There's the introductory segment. And then on page 2 at the bottom, you'll see an asterisk and a number 2. Yeah? That should take you to some commentaries on the bottom of page 3 and on the top of page 4. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if you want to look at some commentaries on the degree to which Leo was hated, take a look there. And if you look on page 3, where it says chapter 30, you'll see asterisk 3. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
In the text? That will take you to some commentaries on page 4, where it says asterisk 3, the argument. Okay? See what I'm saying? So I want you to study the story. I want you to try and figure out, you know, who you think is gaining the advantage. Who's going to be considered to be, dare I use the word, winning? Rachel or Leah? Who's getting ahead? Is there anything you can say about their characters from these stories, right? What can we say about the way that Jacob treats these two women, right? And how do they treat Jacob? And we're going to try and build a sort of characterization of these two women and see how, where that takes us. Okay? So, I'm not quite sure how long we want in the Bet Midrash. You know what? Let's play it by ear. I'm certainly giving you half an hour in the Bet Midrash. You know what? Let's say we'll come back at 12:15. That'll give us enough time, hopefully, to discuss it and to see what we can say of it. Okay? So I'm going to give you 40 minutes in the Bet Midrash to study this, see how you go. It's a rich story. It's a powerful story. Let's see how we do. Okay. Welcome back, everybody. I hope that was interesting. I find this one of the most amazing texts. I just want to clarify something that I said before because I don't want to lead to... I use the word DNA and I don't want people to think that I am necessarily saying that this is genealogical in an absolute biological sense. I also don't want us to think that this is necessarily deterministic. I think we feel we all have choices and... You always have the choice of how to respond to situations, and therefore I don't think that this is something that we are necessarily fated to do. However, we do have this notion that we look at sometimes our avot, our patriarchs, as paradigmatic. Abraham represents certain themes or certain ideas, so does Isaac, so does Jacob. Interestingly enough, it's fun sometimes, I sometimes think, as regards to the patriarchs, who certainly in the traditional prayer book get a lot of coverage, the matriarchs get less. So it's interesting to actually feel the influence of these two of our matriarchs. Give the women a little bit of the limelight here. As with many situations, through conflict and through pressure, sometimes personalities come forth or are formed. So I think I'm not claiming that it couldn't be different, that we cannot excise these ghosts or cannot extricate ourselves from these histories. And yet we do understand that sometimes these histories do have quite a bit to bear, you know, and do very much influence later things. So with that introduction and framing, let's dive a little bit into the story and see what we can say as we go through. I'm going to focus on a few different scenes, but anything to say about the initial, if I read just the first two verses, I'm on page 2. Laban had two daughters. The older one was Leah, and the name of the younger one was Rachel. And Leah's eyes were rakot. Here it says she had weak eyes. Anyone can help me with the translation of rakot? What's rach? Rach is soft. She had soft eyes, which is interesting because I think we all do. So what exactly does that mean? And Rachel was shapely and beautiful. Okay, yifat toar, she had beautiful shape and beautiful appearance. By the way, when you look in the commentaries, they all say, God forbid that the Torah will be describing a lady's figure. And therefore they say, it must be talking about her face, right? You know, she had a good bone structure and good complexion, right? We wouldn't describe anything else about her. That would certainly be inappropriate to say anything more about anything from the neck down. Anyway, it's...
Maybe she was rocked like a crumble. Maybe she was soft like a crumble. Crumbles are these great
desserts. Well, that's it. That's the interesting thing. I was wondering, because we have this notion of Jacob loving Rachel, right? So I just wanted actually wondering what this introduction, which describes their looks, what do you make of all of this? What do you want to say from the beginning?
Well, that's upsetting.
In other words,
it sets it up that there's baggage already before the story starts.
What's upsetting?
Well, we don't really know what we guys means.
Right.
So maybe it's a compliment.
Maybe it's a compliment.
Doesn't feel like that.
Right. Yes.
Right. It doesn't feel that way. So then it's sad because it's supposedly objective. I mean, sort of think that the narration...
So you've got the older sister who doesn't look so great, right? And you've got the younger sister who's stunning, right? And the new guy in town, right, picks the pretty younger sister. And the danger is that the older sister is sort of left on the shelf. Sorry to put it in such crude terms, right? But I'm trying to give the feeling, right? And, we might even imagine that this is not just a new thing to have happened. At the high school prom, it was also she who got, asked out on the date, and Leah was, didn't find some. If you want to read it that way, then this rivalry, as you say, has deeper roots.
That word I want to catch you on, because even if everything you said so far is true, one got blessed with better looks and better bone structure and complexion and so on, I don't think we have any evidence that there's a rivalry, right?
Yes.
They were born looking different, and it is what it is. They're born looking different. Now, later there may be a rivalry that happens, but for the first big chunk of this, there's no evidence that there's a rivalry between the two. They're just pawns in a game.
All right. I can go with that. Yes. You want?
Well, I was saying this is almost an argument for arranged marriages, because in the long run, Leah was a better wife, right? She seems more industrious. She, but young men go for the shiny thing, and it was more of lust, He wanted Rachel, but Leah was really the better choice.
Interesting. That's it.
That's
Scheinsaltz goes with, right?
They didn't get to it,
but that's interesting. I will say this, by the way. I just want to give you two alternative reads. One read is actually that Enelea Rakot, actually, because usually something which is soft, like you say, soft can actually mean fine and delicate, right? Actually, one read is to, I think it's the Ibn Ezra says, that you can read it that they, Leah's feature was that she had stunning eyes, right? And Rachel had a beautiful face. They want to see it as both as compliments. There's actually a... As we say in Hebrew, hafuch al hafuch compliment in Rashi. Rashi has a sort of like a funny read, and it's a very famous read. I'm going to come back to it, but anybody remember the Rashi idea about what caused Leah to have something going on with her eyes?
She knew she was destined to marry herself or something, and cried.
Eyes are destined to marry herself.
Right, so there is a... Right, this is... So many of you have heard it. Well, it comes from the fact that we talk about... The introduction is the older one, the gedola and the katana, and the same phrase is used. Gadol means big, katan little. So the same phrase is used about Esau and Jacob. That you've got the bigger brother, gadol, that's Esau, and Jacob. And the Midrash says, well, there was some family tradition. Let's remember that in the previous generation, Lavan is Rivka, Rebecca's brother, so they'd gone back to get their wives from the homestead back in Mesopotamia, and that they expected the Isaac sons to come back, and now the question is who's going to marry who? Now, if you want to go, and again, we're assuming a lot of things, Esau's sort of rough and evil, right? And Jacob's the pious one. And of course, if we're talking about our matriarchs here, Leah and Rachel are both tremendously pious. And Leah understands that being the Gedolah, who is she destined to marry?
Esau.
Who wants to marry that rough, coarse, evil Esau? And she spends her whole... teenagehood crying, and her eyes are bloodshot from crying, and she has these tender eyes because she's been crying her eyes out, and because she's so righteous, she just doesn't want to marry the Esau, right? And of course, the irony of the story is that they both end up marrying Jacob, of course. But the funny thing is then the thing which sounds like a disadvantage is actually a reflection of her true piety. That's the explanation Rashi. Now, let's bring in a huge lot of midrashic material. And of course, part of it is trying to say that on a spiritual level, these are both fine women, right? And by the way, of course, I think what's even more insightful in the world of the midrash is if we're trying to describe our matriarchs, what we're just interested in their physical features, the outside, what about telling us a little bit about their personalities? And therefore, Leah's tender eyes are reflective of her tender soul, her spiritually attuned soul. And it's saying something interesting, but we'll come back to that when we talk about Rosh Steinsaltz in a few minutes. Now, so this is the introduction, and of course, Jacob falls in love with Rachel. He makes this deal about 7 years, and it seems like these 7 years fly by. You know, what does it say here?
But a few days,
right? Which is because he loves her, right? He loves her. And then, of course, what happens? What do you say? Yeah, switcheroo, right? Which, again, some people say is poetic justice for Jacob having tricked his father. Jacob himself gets tricked by replacing the order of the children. He is the imposter and pretends that he is the older when he is really the younger. And Laban does the same thing to him, right? And switches these girls around. In fact, when he turns around to him and he says in verse 25, he said to Laban, "What is this you've done to me? I was in your service for Rachel. Why did you deceive me?" And Laban said, "It is not the practice in our place," right? And in the translation it says to marry off, but in the Hebrew it says latet. It is not in the Hebrew. I'll read the Hebrew here. He says, "Lo yasechein bin kominu." It is not done in our place to place the younger before the older, right? And some people will say that that is a real burn to Jacob. In other words, you know, here. Yeah. In other words, what you did, we, you know, in other words, we don't. We allow the older to be the older. We marry off the older girl before the younger, right? We don't play around with orders like you do.
I told him that 7 years ago.
That is true. That is true. There is no... there is no doubt that Laban is not in his rights here, but there is seen some sort of poetic justice. Okay. Yeah.
Some punishment happening there in the background.
Some people will say that Jacob is experiencing a punishment. But let's remember that Jacob, throughout his life, is tricked. He tricked his father. He's tricked in this regard by putting the older before the younger, right? He's tricked by his own children, just like he tricked his father. And by the way, how do they trick him? Remember, they take the coat and they dip it into
the blood
of a goat. And he tricked his father with a goat. So many people will see that a lot of Jacob's misfortune are all reverberations of the duplicity that he practiced towards his father, and that what goes around comes around. Called it midah keneged midah, right? A measure for a measure, or however you want to say it. All right, I want to dig deeper into these women. So let's deal with, okay, so now what happens is Leah is, by the way, can we just say one thing? Leah spends the night with Yaakov when he thinks she's Rachel. What do you make of that in terms of Leah? Leah's behavior.
So she's also deceiving him.
Well, she's got a tough choice to make because she's going to deceive somebody here, either her father or her new husband.
Okay.
And she goes with, maintain my loyalty to my father.
Right.
For now.
For now.
I agree.
Okay. Well, this comes into what you see where I put here.
Isn't there something that Rachel actually helped her in?
Yes. There is a midrash. Because the question, of course, is how the heck did this happen? Right? In other words, you can't tell the difference between the two. So by the way, if you want to claim that actually what they said before is true, that the only distinguishing feature of Leah was her eyes, right? And that one could maybe assume that, you know, in the night, if they looked very similar, apart from the eyes and a little bit of the, then maybe they did look very similar, right? Another possibility is that Jacob is drunk from the party, right? it could well be that they, you know, actually their wedding parties were actually pretty, the men celebrating with the men and the women celebrating with the women, right? And they didn't really, you know, by the time, you know, they spent the night together, and I'm not quite sure in what way they spent the night together, assuming that Jacob was half drunk, how much of the night they spent together and in what state of awareness he was, it really could be. In the morning, suddenly, Leah is there, and he hadn't quite realized what had gone on during the night. But the Midrash is like puzzled. Come on, you know the girl. He's spent 7 years in their home. He should be able to tell the difference between their voices. And therefore, the claim is that Lavan is a well-oiled trickster, and Jacob knows that. And therefore, they have some like secret codes, right? Assuming that Laban can do, and that Rachel, again, I'm coming back to the pious read of these two girls, right? And they had some codes, Jacob and Rachel, and Rachel didn't want to embarrass her sister, who she knew, you know, they had locked up Rachel in the house, and Leah was being dressed up as Rachel to take her to the chuppah, and she said, look, my poor sister, she's going to die of embarrassment, right? And therefore she gave over the codes, right? And therefore Rachel, according to this, is an ally to her sister. Now, I'm going to put that Midrash aside. thank you for mentioning, but in that, then the two sisters are really working in cahoots. They're very close, right? They're willing to take a hit. In that regard, Rachel knows she's going to take a hit, and she says, fine, but you know what, Leah, just, I don't want you to get harmed by this, right? And in that regard, the bitter rivalry doesn't come through. In fact, they're really supportive sisters. Was that the impression you got from this text? Right. Okay, so it could be a later development, but I'm saying we get the impression of much greater, certainly as the story develops, right, that maybe there was that initial sibling closeness, and maybe once the man gets in the equation, maybe it all goes a little bit sour. I don't quite know. Yeah. Yes, I didn't. Yeah, I just thought it was too much to get to. I just wasn't sure we were going to get to it. Yes. So the question is, what stage the tension kicks in? Is it already when they're single? Is it before the wedding night? Or maybe it's once the children start coming into the equation, or once Jacob's emotions, right? Because if we read here, we'll see here that, let's just read from verse 30. Okay? Vayavog, it's okay, so what they do is the weddings are separated by a week. They do Sheva Brachot, they do a week of celebration for the marriage to Leah, and then he gets married to Rachel a week later, right? And then he's going to pay that off over the next 7 years, right? And it says in verse 30, Vayavog gam el Rachel, right? He also was intimate with Rachel and loved gam et Rachel mi Leah, also Rachel more than Leah. And he worked another 7 years. And now it says, and God saw that Leah was hated, and Vayiftachet Rachma, and opened her womb, etc. What did you make of this love-hate business? What did you... You probably saw a dispute there between the Radak and the Ramban. I wasn't sure who you maybe decided to opt to go with. Should we just summarize? The Radak says... Anyone?
It's relative.
Right? He may have loved her, but not as much, okay? Whereas the Ramban says?
He hated her.
He detested her because she had tricked him, right? He wanted to marry Rachel, and she got in there, right? Although, what is that, right? Now, by the way, if you look at the text, you'll see that there is a difficulty in the text, which they're really playing on. A few people came out and said, we don't like the Radak. That doesn't work. It says, he hated her. Snu'ah. That's the word in the Hebrew. But I want you to pay attention to the text, which is a little ambiguous, because if you look at verse 30, it says, he was intimate with Rachel and loved Rachel more than Leah. Yeah. So if I would say that, does that mean that Leah's loved?
Yes.
Yes. But then look at the next verse. Now, by the way, that's how he feels. And then it says in the next verse, 31, and God saw that Leah was hated. So if I take hated, and I can actually come up with a very good reason, I think if I was in Jacob's, I probably would hate Leah, right? Me personally, for what she had done to me, unless she was really in some. So.
But doesn't that also hinge on if Rachel gave away their code?
That's true.
Hate her because,
I agree. But still, the question is, if you read 30 as 31 as real hate, then how do you read 30? Do you read it in a sexual sense? Yes.
But maybe he didn't hate her
Right. That's a resentment. Right. Ah, interesting. She hated herself, or she felt.
She felt she was hating.
Ah, so she was hating, or she. No, but they said she was hated. Well, that's what you're saying. She hated on herself. But I.
Well, the first verse is saying how Jacob felt about her, and the second verse is God's perception of how she felt.
Right. And by the way, I think that's very true. Imagine Jacob loves them, but he loves Rachel, as I said, to one. He loves her a 10, and he loves Leah a 7, right? So, so he'll go out with Rachel for date night, you know, once a week, and he brings her flowers every Shabbat, and he'll go out with Leah once a month, right? What does Leah feel? That she, whenever you're comparing, you know, if you're comparing two people in the same job, but one is getting, you know, $2,000 less, you know, they don't feel good about it, right? It doesn't make a difference at the bottom. In other words, once you're making a comparison, right, when I make a comparison, I expect to have some equal. She feels hated. Even if she is loved but less, she's going to feel relatively hated. So her sense is one of resentment. You know what? A lot of people.
7 years for a sister, and then
a lot of people do things,
right?
And don't think about the consequences. And even if she thought about the consequences, it doesn't mean it hurts less, right? Again, I say maybe she felt this was her chance to get. I have no idea what motivated her. I don't know how much in a society like that, how much influence a father could wield over his daughter, right? What he threatened her with to make her go along with this, I have no clue. I don't know what she thought her chances were with the men of the local village, how many dates she'd already been on, and maybe she actually really did like Yaakov and said, you know what, we'll worry about it after the wedding. I have no clue. It's very difficult because the Bible only gives us a very limited amount of information, right? But I think her now, of course, the spotlight turns to Leah. I just want to add one thing, which is this word gun, because I'm going to turn it around to Rachel. Because look at again at verse 30. See, Yaakov and Rachel had for 7 years been, dreaming of this wedding, right? And then expected they will have that opportunity to be together. But there's something very ironic about even Rachel, that it uses this word, verse 30. And I wonder if it comes it's the word also, right? And Jacob cohabited with Rachel also. And by the way, in the Hebrew, it says the also again. And he loved also Rachel, Milea. Rachel also takes a severe hit. What I mean also? You know, when they'd planned that honeymoon in Paris, and they'd planned to, you know, to take that horse-drawn carriage down, the Champs-Élysées, they do. But Leah's sitting between them in the carriage, right? In other words, Rachel is... Sorry, Rachel is always going to be the second.
Right.
There's a certain tragedy about Rachel, this great dream of this great land that they have. You know, how much we can feel sorry for Leah, I'm also going to say there's something which is flawed in the relationship with Rachel because she's always going to be the second. There's that word gum, which I think has to be noted there, right? Also Rachel. He loved also Rachel more than Leah. Yes, he loves her more, but she's also feeling some sense that, you know.
Some tragic sense to everybody involved in the whole story. Every one of them, there's an element of being a victim.
Yeah.
Except that she dies young, and that's more tragic. Because it says that Leah had stopped having children, and that's why he and Yaakov ends up sleeping with Zilpah.
Right.
Right. I mean, she's still young when that happens.
Right.
So
you're saying when you look at the end of the story, right, Rachel is the one who dies in childbirth when she's having a second child, Benjamin. She seems to die the first, which is like, you know, this incredibly, you know, like these tragic stories about, you know, the unbelievable pop star, movie star who ends up, you know, binging on whatever it is and dies at a young age. Like, Rachel's this, like, you know, she's this person who has all this panache and all this romance, right? And yet she's the one who dies first. And you want to know the ultra irony, right? If I ask you, in the Jewish collective memory, right? And that's why I actually mentioned the Midrash before. Who do we see as the crying one? Rachel or Leah?
Rachel.
There's this verse in Jeremiah that Rachel mavaka al baneah, that she's buried by the road. She's not even given, she's not buried in the cave of the patriarchs in Hebron. She's buried by the road. And there's this line in Jeremiah chapter 31, you read it as the Haftarah on Rosh Hashanah, right? That Rachel is seen as crying for her children when they're going into exile. Right? She will not be comforting because her children are not there, and she says, let them come back. The irony is that Leah begins as the crying one, according to the Midrash, but Rachel is the one who is perennially crying. So there's something, if we're talking about tragedy, right? It's fascinating to see this interesting flip. I'm going to talk about that. That's certainly going to be the Steinsaltz perspective, which we're going to come back to. Yes?
So it's interesting we talk about Sarah Rivka, Rachel, and Leah.
Really?
It changed back. I'm not saying it changed originally for all these reasons, but maybe changed back because it just didn't take. But I mean, it's interesting why we say Rachel Balea when really, you know,
right,
in terms of our people, Leah was married first, and Laura came from Leah, and, you know,
interesting.
Why the rabbis list Rachel first.
Right, interesting. It might well be because there is a line in the book of Rut where they bless Rut, and I'm looking for the verse here. Hold on one second. It says, they say to her, Yitein Hashem et ha'isha ha'ba'al beitecha k'rachel uchlea shebanu shtehem et Beit Yisrael. Let them put her like Rachel and Leah, who both together built the house of Israel. And then they put Rachel before Leah. Maybe that's part of it. So it might well be that it actually is, you know, sort of like latching onto that verse from the book of Ruth. Yes?
I wasn't going to bring this up until the theme of crying came forth, and some Midrash and some Shach, but remember that it's Yitzchak who, it says, I should take my other glasses off, by Hiki Zaken Yitzchak, that his eyes, that's the same shorish, the same root, that his eyes, in a sense, were weak with age, and according, of course, to the Midrash, the tears that the angels cried when he was about to be sacrificed caused the sort of
So you're saying there's a Midrashic tradition that a difficult sight doesn't come from cataracts or from other things, but it comes from tears.
Tears.
Right, fascinating. Fascinating idea. Okay, all right. I'm watching the time, so I will need to... Let's just say a little bit about Leah, right? Leah, what do we think of her marriage? It's sad. The first son is called, we chart it by her children, right? Reuven, Ra'ah Hashem Boni, God has seen my suffering. Maybe my husband will love me, okay? The next time, Shimon, right? Because God has seen that I am hated, right? In the Hebrew, in the English, it says,
I was unloved.
In the Hebrew, I have to say, it says, Snua Anochi, which is even more than that. Okay? Levi, right? Hapam yilav eli shielai. Maybe my husband will associate with me. Maybe he'll go with a walk, for me on a walk, right? And then the fourth child, right? Yehuda, right? Hapam odeh et Hashem. Now I'll praise God. Okay? What happened? She started being thankful, right? But
or
why?
Maybe the relationship finally became their own relationship.
So it could be, right? Why would the relationship... Why after three children would the relationship suddenly start taking off?
Well, that makes most men in those days, that would be a good
reason. So in other words... three is a chazaka. Suddenly he's paying more attention to this wife because his wife... is giving him these children, right? I would argue like this, you know, it could well be that he had this initial resentment to Leah because she betrayed him. But once you've got, you know, three kids, right? Well, you need to, you know, we used to make the joke, you had one child, you had two child, it was one-on-one. By the time you got three, it's zone defense, right? You know, three kids, you need somebody to take them to the gun, shashuim, you have to go to the parents' evenings, you have to, you know, how many children at what can you push on the swings at once? He's spending more time with her because he's spending more time with the kids, right? And then maybe, you know, he starts actually, she is quite interesting to talk to. You know, she's got some, you know, wow, she's pretty witty, right? I never even had a real conversation with her before. And she finds her way into his life. That's one possibility. It's not the only one. All right, so I think that's another way. I'm going to put it more extreme than the way you've said it, right? But you could say it like this. You know, after three children, she's like, maybe this child will buy me my husband's life, maybe, maybe. And do you know what? The fourth time she says, you know what? I'm just happy. I've got four kids. I'm really lucky. I'm blessed. You know what? I don't have a great marriage, but I've got four wonderful kids. And she's, in a sense, possibly given up on his love, right? But she says, you know what? I can be happy how I am. You know, not everybody has everything, right? A bit more realistic, right? And she's not bargaining for this. Look, I've got four healthy, beautiful boys, right? And that's where I'm going to put my energy and not crying over what I don't have, right? This is not good. All right, yes.
So, Ruvain, Shimon, and Levi are problematic as children. And it's only Yehuda, right, who becomes the heir, one of the lines through which the kingship will come, only when she could internally reconcile.
Yes, you're 100% correct. Reuven, Shimon, and Levi all get removed from the leadership, and they all make serious mistakes, which has them removed from the leadership, right? And they're all born to a loveless marriage, and it's Yehuda, with this sense, which, you know, I'm not sure whether to quote this or not, but why not? I was once having a private conversation with Rabbi Sachs, and he said, yeah, he said, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi were all screwed up. They were all born into a loveless marriage. And from Yehuda, we can begin again. He actually used that word exactly. it wasn't a speech, but he's written as much in his articles, right? Otherwise, I think there's a point there. Okay, last, you wanted to just say something? You wanted to answer? No? Okay.
Yehuda is also Yehudei Bape with a Dawood.
Right, so we're going to talk about that in a minute. Okay, since I've been told I only have 10 minutes, I'm going to jump to the end of the game. And I would like to give two perspectives. We could talk about this for hours, really. It's such a rich story. We haven't even got to the big fight that, you know, the only conversation between Rachel and Yaakov that we actually hear, direct conversation, is a row. When she says, give me children. He says, you know, what do you want from me? Am I God? Right? And there are all different ways to read that. But certainly some of the rabbinic rules say that's the way to talk about a woman to a woman who's like hurting, right? That's how you talk to her, right? Others want to read it said more softly. He says, listen, I've got children. I can't pray with such passion because however much I try and pray, I can try and pray for you, but I'm praying for you. You're the one without the children. You're really going to have to cry your heart out to God. And she does. And when she eventually has children, it says God listened to her, not listen to him. But I want to go into two different reads of how this plays into history. The first is going to be the read of Rav Steinsaltz. And the second is going to be the read of Rav Kook. And Rav Steinsaltz takes his cue, I think a little bit from Kabbalah, but if you want to look at one of his major texts, it is this Midrash on page 6 from Bereshit Rabbah, source number 12. And he says the following. The elder one was Leah. And this is already where the Midrash is drawing the Avot into and the Imahot into a paradigm, the patriarchs and matriarchs into sort of paradigmatic typological paradigm. And they say like this, the elder one was Leah, really literally the Gedolah, the greater one was Leah, greater in her contributions. the priesthood, which comes from Levi, for posterity. The monarchy, from David, from Judah, for posterity. As it says, and Judah will dwell forever. And the younger, literally the smaller, was Rachel. Of lesser contributions, Joseph, a passing phenomenon, because he was a king for a while, but, you know, his influence waned afterwards. Okay, Saul, temporary. Shiloh, in the tribe of Benjamin, a temporary place for the tabernacle. As it says, he rejected the tent of Joseph. I think traditionally we always see Rachel as the more glamorous and the more, maybe because of those initial comments about beauty and this great love. But he wants to read it very differently. He wants to read it like this. Rachel indeed has the passion, right? But it's a passion which is always unrealized. That great love, that great romantic love, which then becomes gum also. Her great desire for children, right? Which leads to even explosive rows with her husband. And when she gets a son, she calls him Yosef, right? Which means, give me another one. Give me another son. And when she gets the other son, that's the moment that she dies. The story you mentioned of the Dudaim, the mandrakes, is another great example where Reuven comes home with flowers, with mandrakes or something. It's an interesting question what their power was. And she says, I need that. And Leah says, okay, well, if you need it, well, are you willing to give up a night with Jacob? She says, yes, I need it. Rachel has this sort of, needs all sorts of things. She takes her father's idols. She's always needing a great passion, but it doesn't always realize itself. Leah, much more mundane, much more plain Jane, right, in a certain sense. And yet, I'll use a phrase from Hallel, she becomes the Im HaBanim Smicha. She becomes the happy mother. Sometimes I think about that song in Fiddler on the Roof, you know, do you love me, right? Okay, and she says, you know, do I love him, right? You know, I've for 20 years, I've washed his clothes, had his children, do I love him? If that's love, so I love him, right? Okay, I said, let's think about that with Leah, right? Do I love, no, you listen, I've got 6 kids with you. We're in this, I'm buried with you, right? If you call that love, then that's love. She's the mainstay of the family. I don't know how the degrees of romance that they reached, right? And yet, she builds the house, right? That's what the Midrash is saying. Ultimately, she's the one who builds the family, she builds the house, and all of that. How might we compare this? Now, I'm going to say this. I don't want to, I'm not ranking them. I'm going to suggest the following, that these are two very different energies, both needed for the Jewish people. Let me try and describe it in a couple of different ways. I'll say this. Certainly the Rachel characters in Tanakh are frequently more glamorous, right? They are people like, the Rachel characters, like Yosef. Think about Joseph's story. He's tremendously charismatic. And by the way, a lot of externality, his clothes, his good looks, right? And he rises up, and he gets to the top, and boom, he's down in the pit. And then he comes to Potiphar's house, and he rises up, and then boom, in the jail. And then he comes up, meteoric rise, right? That's Joseph. Another character of Rachel's, Benjamin, right? The Benjamin, King Saul, is described as Shichmov Amala, taller than anyone else. He's the guy who rises to the kingship, but can't hold it, right? David characters, you know, actually, interestingly enough, King David, right? When Samuel's coming to anoint the brother, David brothers, he sees his older brother and says, that must be the man. And he says, well, don't look at how he's looked. Don't look at how they look. And he sees this small guy with red hair and sort of interesting eyes. And he says, oh, that's the guy. Even though he doesn't look like a king. I describe it like this. The Rachel energy, by the way, another example, up and down character, external, is Mordechai from Benjamin. Another Rachel character, right? One minute he's wearing clothes of mourning, clothes of royalty. Tumultuous up and down characters. How would I say? By the way, the rabbis talk about two different Mashiachs. A Mashiach a Mashiach of Rachel, a Mashiach ben Yosef, and a Mashiach ben David. The Mashiach ben Yosef is for the birth pangs of the Messiah, the labor pains of the Messiah. The Messiah from David, from Judah, is the King Messiah. What are we saying? I'd compare it to two metaphors. Rachel is the sprinter. Leah is the marathon runner. Rachel gets that speed, right? But how long can you hold the puff? How long can you hold it, right? Leah's the marathon runner, right? Or put it differently. Let's use a business example, right? You know, Rachel is the startup entrepreneur. She's got the great new ideas. Wow, I've got this new idea. She comes up with the idea, but how do you turn it into profitability? How do you take that idea and ensure that it develops? Sometimes the entrepreneur will come in. This happened in Apple right at the beginning, right? Comes up with a great big idea, but then after the first wave, okay, now what? Now what? Now? And you lose the tension. They bring in, you know, a gray-suited, you know, executive, right? But he knows how to run the company and take it to profitability and all that sort of stuff. Might we say that the Yosef, the Rachel, is this tremendous startup energy, right? And that's going to take us through the birth pangs, through the labor pains of the Messianic period to transitional, whereas we bring the Leah to take us through this, the steady. Okay, so that's going to be one model. And what I'm saying is like this. You can imagine two personalities like this, might even in a corporate environment, might rub up against each other. The entrepreneur who's a little reckless, a little, you know, and the gray-suited executive, they might drive each other crazy. A bit like Rachel and Leah have that tension. A bit like the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom have that tension, right? But how can I say it? We want to graft them both. We need them both. We need both. We want Rachel and Leah to be our ancestors. The question is, can we get along? I'll give you the second model, and I'll do it really quickly because I realize we don't have the time. The second essay, which I put here, I put it on page 6, 7, is an essay by Rav Kook. Rav Kook, many people seeing as the father of religious Zionism in certain ways. Rav Kook came out of Volozhin Yeshiva, Eastern Europe, a Haredi rabbi, but really fell in love with Zionism, and saw it as a fulfillment of the Jewish legacy, the return to the land. And he, in 1904, decides to eulogize Herzl. Now, Herzl was vilified by the rabbinic establishment. Here's a guy who's a totally secular Jew. You know, might have fallen in love with the Zionistic dream, but let's remember that the Zionistic dream frequently, right, meant a sort of discarding of the ancient Jewish narrative of waiting for the Messiah. What's this idea of us taking matters into our own hands? The religious groups only came on much later in the Zionist congresses, right? Both the religious Zionists and the Aguda, for sure, only came on later. And he was vilified in religious circles when Rav Kook got up to give this speech. There were posters all over Jerusalem. Well, maybe that's not a surprise today, but saying, you know, how's this rabbi daring to praise Herzl? But this is what he said. And he said the following. He said, there is a power of Rachel and a power of Leah, or maybe better put, there is a power of Joseph and there's a power of Judah. I'll say that, by the way, in many generations, leaders come from, if you remember in the wilderness years, the two very significant leaders, Kalev and Yehoshua. Kalev, Yehuda. Yehoshua, Ephraim, right? One Yosef, one Yehuda, right? So many different generations, the leaders come from each tribe. He says this, there is a force of Yosef and there's a force of Yehuda. Yosef, he says, represents the universal. Yosef is the mashpir, according to, he is the economist, right? He's the genius of infrastructure, right? He knows how to run a national economy. The Midrash says that Yosef spoke 70 languages. What does that mean? The Yosef represents the universal, right? He's connected to everyone. He is the diplomat. He can relate to the world. He relates to something universal. Yehuda. As somebody said before, Yehuda has in his name, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the name of God. I have a son, actually my fourth son, partially because of this, is called Yehuda. And when he used to be in Gan, when he used to be in kindergarten, you know, they have to write their name, but they write it sometimes wrong. So a few times he came back and he'd written Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh on his artwork. And I, you know, at least I present, put it on the fridge and say, look at my son! He's amazing. Anyway, you know, no, but really, Yehuda, we have this sense, as we say in Hallel, Haita Yehuda l'kodsho, right? Rav Kook imagined that Yehuda represents, if you want, the inner Jewishness. Yehuda represent the Kodesh, represent the inner spirit of Judaism. Yosef represents the universal strain, right? Maybe drawing, you know, on a riff of this idea of sort of Rachel being the appealing to the outside and Leah having sort of this inside, drawing on those sort of midrashic roots. And he says that, you know, in the same way as you have a body and a soul, we can't have a Judaism without the infrastructure which supports it. This big chiddush of Herzl, that we want to create a state with a government, with a railroad, with an economy. He says, you religious people, you're saying, no, 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 we need to be in the Beit Midrash. We need to be spiritual. But you need to eat, right? We as a nation, we need an army. We need a government. We need commerce. That's Yosef. Yosef is the one who we sent down to help the Jews survive in Egypt. He came down first. Herzl's vision is to establish the Yosef. It's universal. Yes, it's an economy like the rest of the nations. It's a railroad like the next nations, but we need it. That's Yosef. Now, on top of that, we need to put the Yehuda. Are you going to, Yehuda, going to fight Yosef? Are you religious people going to fight Yosef? Or are you going to work with Yosef? Are you going to build on top of Yosef? Are you going to fight forever? Because we've done that fighting. We've already done it, right? Or can we create what we now call a religious Zionism, accept that we need to have a nation state, right? But that we need to pour some Jewish content into it, right? And that we need to learn how to build the two and for the two to work in harmony. So what I'm saying is, and by the way, now let me just take a step back. According to both these interpretations, and I don't believe these are hard interpretations, but we can see these in both cases as different fault lines in any corporation, any organization, or the Jewish people. And what I'm saying is, what I see in Rachel and Leah, I already proved in my opening lines that there had always been a sort of like ethnic split between them. It's no surprise, whether you want to call it Ashkenazim, Sephardim, whether you want to call it Israel, diaspora, whatever, that there are different, religious, secular, whichever grouping you want to go on, there are lots of reasons for us to be different. And you look at these stories, right? When we feel passionate about things, and when rivers run deep, when passions run deep, there is clearly the tendency for it to create friction. The aim and the vision that Ezekiel spoke about was, can we graft ourselves together? Can we take the tree of Ephraim, whatever that might be, and the tree of Judah, and put them together? We've got enough acrimony in our history. The reason why these stories are here, I mean, again, I said this to one Chavruta, in the first generation, Abraham, we boot one son out. Ishmael is ejected. In the next generation, Esau is ejected. Jacob is the first generation where we all stay together as one family. The assumption is we're holding 12 different qualities, 12 energies together, right? Now, the advantage of staying together is that we have all of that. The question is, can we stop ourselves from breaking apart? And the Bible's telling me that we want to hold these energies together. The question is how we can learn to appreciate, how Rachel can appreciate Leah, how Leah can appreciate Rachel, how we can live with those awkward cousins who represent things that we aren't the things I necessarily appreciate, but be able to join the tree of Ephraim to the tree of Judah and to become one, as it says, one people in the land with one king over them, to be able to stay one family. So we will leave it there. Thank you.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.